Well, it had been very, very long anticipated, hadn't it? There were all kinds of questions about what exactly would be the details of interest. After all these months and months and months, finally, it was revealed. On April 29th, you got to see Kate's dress. What a wonderful spectacle indeed. 2 billion people watching it, hundreds of thousands filling the streets of London, looking and participating and entering into this royal feast of pageantry and import. People got all excited, and there are all kinds of memorabilia and all kinds of pictorials and magazines and things you can buy, souvenirs that just examine almost every detail of that event. We all like a good show. Talk is abuzz, even on the blogosphere. Did Pippa, Kate's sister, steal the show with her dress, her hourglass shape? They had lip readers to interpret those little sweet sayings that Will said to Kate and the Queen uttered as they passed by and waved. The wonderful procession and even people talking about the kinds of hats and fascinators. Isn't that an interesting word that people wore on their heads? Now I'm told on auction for tens of thousands of dollars. All kinds of details about the royal wedding. What I wonder, and except for the running commentary when the wedding was being displayed, as it were, and broadcast, I have not heard anyone that I've spoken to or any commentator who speaks or refers to the wedding now these days ever mention the content of the sermon addressed to Will and Kate. They talk about the dress and the flowers and the hats and the beauty in the choir, those crystal clear voices of the children, all kinds of, but I don't hear anyone commenting on what the bishop said to them in his sermon. Well, let me remind you of some of those things. The first of which, he said, every wedding is a royal wedding, with the bride and the groom as king and queen of creation, making a new life together so that life can flow through them into the future. And at the outset of his message, he began with a quote from St. Catherine of Siena, reminding the world, watching and listening, in addition to Kate and Will, be who God meant you to be, and you will set the world on fire. Went on to talk about faithful commitments and love and the wonderful dance of God in the midst of all of that. He also reminded them and all who would listen that more and more as people abandon God as a significant reference of life, a significant part and factor in decision-making and so forth, more and more there is increasing pressure for partners as they come together to provide all that is necessary for the human soul and human well-being, and it is too much to bear. And he counseled them to welcome and to look for and to engage with God, for they could not satisfy each other's most noble desires and aspirations, for they are physical, they are spiritual, they are psychological, they're all the full plethora of that beauty that constitutes us as human beings. But God is necessary to bring that fulfillment. He reminded them of that. Wise words, but a part of the service that's relegated to insignificance almost by all who commented on it after. I want to borrow, in a sense, from the sentiment to remind us, as the scripture lesson from 1 Peter says, that all of us are royalty. And so, may I, your royal highnesses. You, says the author, are a chosen people, a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, chosen by God, belonging to God for a particular purpose. This text, as we are reminded by Jesus and those who have come before, confers upon us an identity and an integrity that God has chosen to give unto us. You are royalty. You are esteemed in the heart of God as uppermost in God's concern for the redemption of all of creation. Your royal highnesses. I remember, and I know what it can be like to want to be like a prince or a princess. In high school, I liked this girl, and I'd had visions of being that princely rescuer, brave and courageous. Had visions of protecting no matter what. We were walking on the street one day. Another student who had liked her, a big fellow with whom she had had some trouble, approached us. He didn't even pay me any attention at all, just started being aggressive verbally towards my friend. And I thought to myself, here's my chance. And I stood, took one step in front and said, "You leave her alone," and put my hand out. Foolish me. And this big, hulking student just took my hand and twisted it away. And I was crushed. It was my friend who stepped forward and spoke to this young man with a firm voice and a strident cadence that set him on his heels, and he turned and went. There went my chance to be brave. But you know, what this text defines for us is a particular way in which we live out our royalty, live out our royalness, live out our special calling. It is not to act in ways that seem courageous to bring favor and reputation to ourselves. It is to join God in those courageous acts of proclaiming the wondrous works of God. For we're told we are chosen for a particular reason in order to proclaim the marvelous works of God. Remember to whom these words are being addressed. There are Gentile Christians, by and large, who are living in various parts of Asia Minor, which is modern-day Turkey. They're under persecution. Nero and the others have decided that these Christians are an irritant. Not only have they moved to new places, we know they're aliens, resident aliens, as it were, where they are living. And so they are ostracized and oppressed, excluded from the fabric of society. They're living on the margins. And this word comes to them to remind them that they are esteemed and privileged in the sight of God. And their calling is not for them to fit into society, but for them to bless and mend and be salt and light where they live, to be confirmed in their identity and to experience the profound sense of God's love. I've just come back from 5 days away in Minneapolis attending the annual conference of Festival of Homiletics. And it was a challenging time. It was an uplifting time and an animating time as well. But challenging, because the theme was preaching and changing culture. And speaker after speaker acknowledged what we already know, that in the West, in North America, the mainline church at least is shrinking. Churches are closing. People are abandoning religion, as it were, as it's conceived and expressed in the package, if you will, of the congregation and of denominations. There seemed to be some anxiety around, and some of the speakers were talking about feeling some sense of responsibility. On my watch, this has happened. One said, I've been ministering for 35 years, and this is happening on my watch. How am I to interpret my work? There is a collective sense, indeed, however, that there was hope to be found. One speaker even said that this decline, it may be we need to be brave enough to recognize that it is the work of God, that somehow the way in which this faith has been packaged and expressed is not offering the life and the release and the sense of joy that it's necessary, and therefore something new is to be birthed. And we know, because the pattern of death and resurrection is our mainstay, is the crux of our story. So maybe there's some things that just have to die in order to make room for new life. And I came away feeling emboldened and feeling hopeful. Not because it might change whether hordes of people come or not, but being reminded and reconfirmed in this first love that I have known. My heart and my life is constrained to do what I do. There are times when I do not feel I am doing this by choice. It is because of this identity, this call that has been placed upon my life by God, that you are called to come alongside people and to remind them and point them and express to them the way of God and the way of love. You are called to help them exegete, help them find out how their lives intersect, that every moment of every day with your willing and loving and concerned purpose for their lives, you are meant to be a student of their lives and of the life of the wider world to see where I am at work. Forget about the numbers. Go deep. And this word that comes in 1 Peter to those Christians is an affirming word. It reminds them that it is this Jesus whom others are forgetting and abandoning, the cornerstone that they are rejecting. But what God is doing is shaping them into living stones that is the building a spiritual house. And whether it's 1 or 5 or 20 or 50 or 200 or 500, the thing that matters is that those are there committing themselves to live this life of grace. Live this life where they are captured by the beauty and elegance of God so that they will be shaped into living stones and build a spiritual house where people can find hope and rest for their soul, forgiveness for their sin, mercy for their wrongdoing, direction for their aimlessness, hope for their despair, life for their death, obedience for their waywardness. I want to be part of that living stone. And notice that the text says the living stones are being made into. It is God who is doing the making. We place ourselves at God's disposal. In the gospel lesson, the disciples, as we see again, don't get it. Jesus is nearing, we've moved back now in terms of the timeline before the crucifixion. Jesus is nearing his end. And he wants to convey to the disciples, just how do you live this life of being made a spiritual house? How do you live out your chosenness? Remember, Jesus has told them already, you did not choose me, I chose you. How do you live this out? He says, do not let your hearts, it says, do not let your hearts be troubled, but the Greek is more powerful. Do not let your hearts be overwhelmed. How much in our life and in our world overwhelms us? And Jesus is not speaking as someone naive about what is going on. There is trouble at the door. Betrayal is afoot. Denial has already been signaled. The wheels have been set in motion for his own demise. There is trouble at the door. He's not some kind of naive fool saying, don't let your hearts be troubled. Do not let them be overwhelmed, even in the midst of crisis and anxiety and pain. Don't be overwhelmed. Why? Because I am with you. Don't be overwhelmed because I'm going to show you the way. Not only show you the way, I am the way. So hitch your wagon to me. Walk with me. Bless with me. Love with me. Forgive with me. I will model how you are to live out your chosenness, your royal highness identity. Watch me. Be with me. It doesn't seem to be enough for them, and sometimes for us, it's true. We want something more. That doesn't seem real enough. Philip says, show us the Father. Thomas says, we don't know the way. Jesus says, I'm standing right here. You want to see the Father standing right here? Look at me. Remember how I have lived. You want to know how the Father loves? Remember how I took children on my knee. How I touched the leper. How I went out of my way to include the sinner. How I prized and valued and honored women in a society that did not. You want to see the Father? Look at me. This is how you live out your royalty. I like the way that Eugene Peterson puts it in his book, The Way of Jesus. To follow Jesus implies that we enter into a way of life that is given character and shape and direction by the one who calls us. To follow Jesus means picking up rhythms and ways of doing things that are often unsaid, but always derivative from Jesus, formed by the influence of Jesus. To follow Jesus means that we can't separate what Jesus is saying and what Jesus is doing and the way that he is doing it. To follow Jesus is as much, or maybe even more, about our feet as it is about our ears and our eyes. Jesus got it right. The Beatles got it right. The Buddha got it right. Paul got it right. Love is what it's about. Love is what it's about. Richard of St. Victor, mystic, said, when the soul is plunged into the fire of divine love like iron, it first loses its coldness and dullness. And then growing into white heat, it becomes like unto fire itself. And lastly, it grows liquid and loses its nature, is transmuted into an utterly different quality of being. As the difference between iron that is cold and iron that is hot, so is the difference between the tepid soul and the soul made incandescent by divine love. The way in which Peter begins this particular text is absolutely crucial. And I want to say this and emphasize, because in the midst of our attempts to live out our Christian faith, we too often believe it is up to us. We strive more than we need to. When what is really being called for is that we receive. So the text begins, like newborn babies, drink from the spiritual milk. Now that's not an image that many of us may feel comfortable with. Thank God for the babies amongst us to remind us of that. Like newborn babies. And Cole and Audrey and Olivia are reminding us today of that love that is conferred upon them. Decisions we have made for them. They have not decided themselves. They are in receipt of a blessing from us and mostly from God. And the reason I raise that is because the very earliest picture or image or painting we have of Mary, the mother of Jesus, is as a nursing mother. in the catacombs of Priscilla in Italy. And up until the middle of the 18th century, this was one of the dominant ways of depicting Mary in relation to Jesus. And it is a lost icon, a lost image, I believe. And here is why. I believe in the vulnerability of God coming in the flesh in Jesus demonstrates a posture of how we are to receive what is necessary to live the Christian life. Like a newborn, receive spiritual milk. Let me ask you a question. Have you ever noticed? Where do we live in our part of the universe? Where do we live? In the Milky Way. Do you know that the word galaxy comes from the Greek gala, which means milk? Here is a wonderful nuancing of imagery to remind us that this God, taking an image, as it were, of a nursing mother, will feed us with what is necessary to live out our identity as royal highnesses. And the reason being is that much of our life is complicated because we believe that we must fight and strive and do it ourselves rather than be in a posture of receiving. Let us remind ourselves every single day we receive the very foundational aspects of our living. How many of you by striving can make your heart beat? Every day you receive the gift of your heart beating. How many of you by striving can create the oxygen necessary for life? Every day we receive what is necessary for life. So too, we receive the milk of God, which reduces our egos and teaches us to be receptive to the grace of God and the love of God. Put away all defenses against the raw, naked love of God, because that is what will help us know what it means to live as the chosen race, the royal priesthood, the holy nation. That will free us from all kinds of stridency and judgmentalism and grudge holding, so that in our living, in our forgiving, in our testifying, in our confessing, we may proclaim the marvelous works of God. May it be so. May you and I be released today to be the royalty that we are by the love and grace of God. For the world needs that kind of show. Amen.